The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And today's show is one of the most interesting and adventuresome that I've been involved with. My guest is Mildred Muhammad. The name may not mean much to you, but it will mean a great deal before we're done today talking with her. Our lives, our paths crossed in a most unusual and terrifying fashion back in 2002. Her former husband, John Allen Muhammad, is the infamous, or was, the infamous DC sniper, or Beltway sniper. He's known to have shot 13 people hiding in the back of his truck with his gun sticking out of the trunk, along with his very young companion, Malvo. He stymied the police of several states as he carried on his activities in the D.C. region, particularly in Maryland and Virginia. You may remember the infamous looking for the white men in a white van, which turned out not to be the case. What motivated this man was never clear to me until yesterday, when I got to talk at some length with the woman who was at the time of these multiple serial murders, his ex-wife. This is a story, as her book says, and her book, incidentally, is called simply Scared. If you look at the cover, Scared, the subtitle, When the One You Love Becomes the One You Fear, you'd think you were reading a book that's wholly about another subject that troubles society, which is domestic abuse, and particularly the abuse of wives by their husbands. But this is a story that has such incredible interlocking themes of huge societal importance. As the back of the book says, this is a story of domestic violence that ended up terrorizing millions. I lived in Montgomery County, and my daughter lived in particular very near one of the gas stations where he, shooting at a distance, shot and killed an innocent, truly innocent, random individual, an available target. One of his later shootings was in a shopping center quite some distance away down in Fredericksburg, Virginia, but that too was a place that we frequented since we had at the time a house on a lake that we would escape to on the weekends. That was not far from there on Lake Anna. Now, this story is not going to be an easy one to disentangle, but our guest today, Mildred Muhammad, is certainly going to be able to help us. When she first talked to me on the phone, she told me that basically these murders centered around her husband's desire to kill her, and she can tell you more about that story, and that this was in some ways a cover-up so that he could kill her along with this well-established pattern of serial murder, and then although he'd be the obvious one to be accused of killing her, he would be, in a sense, let off because it would have been a matter of chance that she was victimized by the D.C. sniper. And I, when I first heard that, I was skeptical in my mind, but it didn't take me long to find out that, in fact, this is a view brought forward by the defense and the prosecution alike, that Mildred Muhammad was at the center of this. This brings up all kinds of interesting questions, but there are other issues too, which I didn't, Ms. Muhammad and I, Mildred and I didn't get to talk about, but which she might want to address some, which is also the jihadist aspect of what he may have been doing, and I'd be interested in her opinion on that as well. I am really glad to welcome Mildred Muhammad to the microphone. Are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you're actually one of the more interesting people and challenging for me because you take me out of my comfort zone of okay. what I know about and what I'm certain or more or less certain about in life. As we talked about, I thought we might begin, but we can go in any direction you're comfortable with. I thought we might begin with some information that you may have that's very unique to your possessing it about the D.C. sniper or the Beltway sniper, your former husband, John Muhammad. Perhaps we could begin there and then move on.
Well, I did not know at the time the shootings were happening that it was John. As you indicated, the profilers gave gave us a description of the people we should be looking for, two white men in a white box truck. Prior to coming to the Maryland area, I was in Washington State trying to get custody of my children from John because he had kidnapped them and had taken them to Antigua.
And are you there? You okay?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm sorry. And because he was... Let me go back a little further, if I may. We were married for 12 years, and we have three children. When John went to Saudi Arabia for the first Desert Storm, he was a combat engineer, expert shot, and he could make a weapon out of anything. His motto was one shot, one kill to the head. He always practiced headshots. And when he went, before he went to Saudi, he was a jovial person. He was the life of the party. Everybody wanted to be around John. When he came back, he was a totally different person. He was distant. He no longer wanted anyone to know what was going on inside of his head. He was diagnosed with PTSD, and he had an injury to his shoulder, which brought him home in a different way where he was not able to be debriefed. We went forward, and he didn't want me to know anything that was going on with him. So it was difficult to try to get him help because he felt he didn't need any help. And in the military, you can't have a stain on your record, especially a mental issue, then you will not be able to be promoted. So he did not get the help, although he was diagnosed with PTSD.
Mildred, do you know, was he ever on psychiatric drugs?
No, sir, he was not. He was not.
So he probably didn't want to. It may have been one of the reasons he didn't want to get help, because the soldiers all knew they would be put on drugs.
You're probably right.
Go ahead with your story. So he came back, he's got a diagnosis of PTSD.
Right.
He's a changed man.
Right. He is no longer the same jovial person. He's quiet. He's sitting in a corner pondering what his future is going to look like and how he's going to move forward, not sure of how he was going to get there. And so we moved from Denmark, Germany. That's where we were. back to California. That's what he ETS to estimated time of service. That's what that means, going to another duty station. And when we got there, everything was fine, or so I thought, but then his behavior became even more bizarre. And when we moved from there to Tacoma, Washington, and it was there that he really began to unravel. I asked him for a divorce because he was seeing other women on the side, and I said, you know, you're free. You may as well, you're acting free, you may as well be free. And that's when all of the true madness began, because he still had a key to the house. He was no longer living with us, our three children. And he would come in the middle of the night. He would, I could hear the key going in the door, because I could hear the key going in the door. And as he came in, it was dark in the house, but him being military, his night vision kicked in, and I could see him coming to the bed, walking around it, and my spirit told me to be quiet. Don't move, or he's going to hurt you. And I did exactly that. I just watched him walk around the bed. And so then I called the locksmith to have the locks changed, because if he had access to the house, I was afraid he was going to hurt me. They came, changed the locks on the door. So then he had my phone number changed several times, and I had to call the phone company to ask them to put a code on it so he could no longer have access to the phone calls. I got a restraining order, which was a lifetime restraining order, because he had come to the house, and he said, you know what? You have become my enemy, and as my enemy, I will kill you. John was not a man that spoke idle words. He said what he meant, and he meant what he said.
When is this in terms of what will become the shootings in October 2002?
Well, when he kidnapped the children and he took them to Antigua, that's where
Had he threatened you before he went to Antigua?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. And so what year is that, roughly?
This is 2000.
2000?
Yes, sir.
Okay, March, so just 2 years before.
2000, that was my mother's birthday. That's why I know that day specifically, when he kidnapped the children.
Mm-hmm.
And he took them to Antigua he was gone for 18 months. He had them on a weekend visitation, and he didn't bring them back. And I didn't know where they were. And he emptied all the bank accounts, and he called the landlord and said he would no longer pay the rent. The people around us were checking on me, reporting back to him what I was doing. They knew where my children were, and they didn't tell me. So fast forward to, I got my divorce October 6th of 2000. Got to Maryland because my mother was sick and had pneumonia, but I was still hiding. I went to the FBI, told them that he kidnapped the children. They said, well, since he's looking for you, Ms. Muhammad, we want to put you in the middle of a parking lot and use you as a decoy. I said, excuse me, it's going to be a headshot. How is that going to help me? And they said, well, we're just trying to help you out. So I didn't go back to them for help. The executive director of the shelter I lived in said, they found my children. I need to fax my paperwork to get them back. I did that. I had to fly back to Tacoma, go to an emergency custody hearing where John threatened me in court. I flew back to Maryland under skies. That was in September of 2001. And shortly thereafter, the September 11 happened. So fast forward to September 2002, shootings began in the D.C. area, and then in October, they really became like four, was October the 2nd, I think it was four shootings in one day. And all this time, I'm hiding. I'm looking for John, and I'm looking for the profile that they told us to look for. It would be October the 23rd.
Mildred, did it even cross your mind it might be your husband, your ex-husband?
No. Yeah. Because I didn't think he was that stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I thought just what they told us to think. Oh, two Caucasians in a white box truck.
Right.
But I was looking for John, too, because John was a hunter. He was a scout. He knew how to track people. And so October the 23rd, ATF knocked on my door and asked me when was the last time I had seen him, ATF meaning alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And I told them that I hadn't seen him for a year ago at an emergency custody hearing. They took me in for questioning, and they said, Ms. Muhammad, you know, we're just going to have to tell you. We're going to name your ex-husband as a sniper. And I put my head on the table, and I was like, what? It's like, yes, we are. Say, do you think he would do something like this? I raised my head. I looked in the corners of a room, and I was like, yes. I said, why would you think that? I said, because we were watching a movie, and I don't remember the name of it, but he said I could take a small city, terrorize it. They would think it would be a group of people, and it would only be me. And they said, well, Ms. Muhammad, didn't you know you were the target? I was like, well, how would I know that? And they say, well, if you, I said, I don't know the area. They say, well, we need to put you in protective custody. So they took me into protective custody. We went over to get my children. And then that's when I told my children, they're going to name your dad as the sniper, because we had no idea that was him. When we got to the hotel, they were taking us, and that's when they showed his picture for the first time on TV. And we had to wait there until they caught him. Once they caught him, they said that, you know, you're no longer in imminent danger, so we're going to let you go home. But before you go, Ms. Muhammad, you have to pay the food bill, because although we say we would put you in protective custody, we didn't say that we would pay for you and your children to eat. And so the trial began. They brought in witnesses, and they found him guilty. The foreman said that the reason they gave him the death penalty was because they felt that he would finish what he started, which was to kill me. And then he was executed in November of 2009.
Wow. How have you been doing? At some point, you decided to become active about this, and you wrote Scared Silent.
Well, Scared Silent is based upon my journals. I journaled through the whole process because I had nobody to talk to. Nobody could help me. I went to counselors. Unfortunately, they said that there was nothing they could do for me because they go by case studies, and since there was no case like mine, they didn't know how to help me. So I went to the library, and I got a book on counseling, and I learned how to counsel me and my children myself. And I continued to journal until I was able to stop reacting and start acting and get proactive in trying to handle my own emotions so that I can help my children to handle theirs. I never spoke badly about their father to them. To this day, I don't. They're old enough now to see and know everything that he did, how he orchestrated all of this, and how they need to move forward, because I told them that they will not use their dad as an excuse for failure. So my daughters sing opera in 8 different languages, and my son works in computer information systems.
Wow. It's an amazing story of what you have been through. When did you first meet your former husband? When? How far back did you go in his life? The children,
that was 1983.
Since 83.
Right.
Now, most acts of violence or horrific acts like this, they're going to have a number of factors at work. Now, Malvo, who was the boy that your husband recruited and sort of befriended and I guess made like a son of sorts and then used,
right.
He spoke of this as being partly a jihad. And I think, didn't your husband, wasn't he an activist of some kind before all this began?
No, he wasn't. He was a simple person. He when he took the children away, he took them to Antigua, and he met Lee. Lee was looking for a father figure. He brought Lee in as the big brother over our children. And by all accounts, that's just what he was, a big brother. He and my children were, at that time, best friends. So John, what he was doing to make money, he would falsify documents, birth certificates, airline tickets, passports, for individuals who wanted to be citizens of the United States. And he would bring them over, I guess you would call that human trafficking, and welcome them into the United States. They would pay him $3,000 for that process, and then he would go back and get more people.
While so John Malvo was doing this, the boy?
No, John. John was doing this.
John
Malvo
Alan
was in Antigua watching the children while he did that.
I gotcha. It's a complex story. So
there's
some implication in what I've read, and I don't have any expertise on this at all. There's an accusation that he may have fragged, that is, he may have assaulted some other soldiers through some sort of a grenade into a tent. There's other talk about his having been involved with the Nation of Islam in the U.S., which is not itself a terrorist group, obviously.
Right.
But that he was actively involved in some ideological way. And I thought that Malvo had said some of the same things. You think not?
Well, I know that there was an incident in Saudi Arabia that had to do with a hand grenade. I don't know all a thermal grenade. I don't know all of the specifics about that because each time I ask, I get a different story. So I can't give you accurate information with that. In terms of him being in the Nation of Islam, he was a member, but he got out. So at the time of the shootings, he was on his own. He was not recruited by anyone to do what he did. It was his own plan in his own mind in order to get custody of the children and to not have me involved in their lives.
It's an astonishing concept.
When I testified for Lee Malvo, because my children asked me to, they said that if it wasn't for Dad, Lee would not be there. His attorney asked me, did I recognize him? And I said, no, sir. He said, well, Ms. Muhammad, they found you. You see, John sent Lee to your door to pose as a salesperson, and his instructions were, when you open the door, to shoot you in the face and kill you. But Ms. Muhammad, you opened the door. And for whatever reason, Lee walked away. We don't know all of the repercussions he suffered because he did not kill you at that time.
God, when was that? When was that, Mildred?
In the month of October when the shootings were taking place.
Oh, my gosh. This is an incredible story. I think you're a very honest and accurate reporter. It jives with my skimming of some of the issues surrounding the case.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any additional insight to give us in this first half hour? Then I want to talk more about your life, which you've already touched on, and your children, and the whole larger issue that you've become a spokesperson surrounding, you know, domestic violence, but domestic abuse. Any more to tell us about what drove your ex-husband to behave in such a bizarre and horrific fashion?
You know, I wish I knew, Peter, because there was no reason for any of this to take place. I never tried to keep him away from his children. He had access to them at any time. When he kidnapped them, he cut off all ties. They were gone from me for 18 months. I had no clue of where they were. They were on the border of Canada in Bellingham. That's where the police officers went to a shelter to pick them up and bring them back through CPS. So this was a long, drawn-out process that did not have to happen. The way they caught him is his best friend called the FBI in the midst of the shooting and said, I don't know anything about your case, but you may want to look at John Allen Muhammad. His ex-wife is in the area, and he may be there to hurt her. That's when they turned their attention to finding out all they could about John. And that
she was central in his discovery as well.
Yes, sir.
Wow. It's just amazing. Now, you knew John since then. He was he was still a young man, but since he was quite young.
Right, 20.
What did you see, and we'll talk more about this in the second half, but you see the seeds in his being emotionally abusive, the seeds of the man who would become that violent?
You know, he never talked about any abuse he suffered. He did not want to appear weak. He did not want anybody to know that he had come from abuse. I didn't find out any of that until I was reading the articles myself. So he never spoke about that. He never wanted anybody to know. When I met John, he couldn't read. I taught him how to read.
Oh, wow.
So him learning how to read, taking the test to go, he was in the National Guard. So he said, I want to leave this place, which was Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I want to see the world. And the only way I can do that is in the military. So I helped him to learn how to read and to take the test that he passed to get into active duty.
Did he graduate high school without knowing how to read?
Yes, he did. He graduated high school.
Yeah, that happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Would you describe him as a really intelligent man?
He was very intelligent because when he asked me to help him to learn how to read, he had a photographic mind where he had you to read something to him, and then he could give it back to you verbatim and then add to it to make it appear that he knew what he was talking about and you didn't know he couldn't read.
Oh, my goodness. And that's partly how he got through school and just neglect
as
well.
Yes, that is how he got through. He's a very, very smart man, and they underestimated him. Law enforcement underestimated him. And I was trying to get them to understand, you're not dealing with a regular person here. This man was trained in the military. So he has information in his head that is not privyed to a lot of other people. So you're not handling him in the manner that you should. You got to step up because he knows what he's talking about. When they were going to take him from Virginia to Maryland, they were going to drive him there. I say, you know, I would not do that if I were you. There are people that feel that John is a hero, and there are people that like him, and you don't know if those people are going to be on that road to try to break him out. I know this sounds like a movie, but I'm just telling you that it would be better if you flew him over, and they flew him over.
So they listened to you?
They listened to me.
Did you testify in the trial?
I testified in the sentencing phase because the judge would not allow the domestic violence in the trial because the laws are not strong enough in domestic violence for it. And even in the sentencing phase, the jury was not given the opportunity to hear my full testimony.
So they thought it would distract from the violence?
Correct.
Yeah. They didn't want to humanize him either, probably.
Right.
They didn't want to show all of his life to the jury.
Right.
What may I ask what you well, it was public, so I'm sure you're comfortable with it. What did you testify to in the sentencing phase?
They asked me, when did he change when he came back from the military, and I told them yes. They asked me more yes or no question. But, you know, I was so terrified of John in that courtroom. When they gave me that subpoena, I went home, looked up the courtroom online, and found a door behind the witness stand. So when I got to the courthouse, I asked them, could I go through the back door of the witness stand because I don't know if you all can protect me in that courtroom because John is going to snap my neck. And before you blink, he will have done it. And they was like, no, Ms. Muhammad, we have to take you through the front. We'll just put some guards around you. But I was terrified in the courtroom.
My
children had written letters,
and
they wanted me to read the letters in the courtroom of what they said. And those are online. If you Google letters for DC Sniper, from DC Sniper's children, then they're online because it's public record.
Mildred Muhammad, we're going to take a brief break. And then we'll have another about 25 minutes. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. We've been talking with Mildred Muhammad, author of Scared Silent, and the former wife of the infamous DC sniper. Let's go to break.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my guest today, Mildred Muhammad, author of Scared Silent, former wife of the DC sniper who shot 13 people, killing nearly all of them, and perhaps some other folks too, earlier on from some of the reports. Mildred Muhammad, I thought we would spend now more of our focus on what you've been through yourself, how you've been able to relate to other people, the good and bad about how they've related to you, where you've found the strength, where you have found the strength to move on as you have. So begin anywhere you like with those themes.
Well, I had to be strong for my children is always and has always been about them, making sure that they were in a safe and stable and happy environment. And in order for that to happen, I needed to take care of me, because if I'm a mess, then my children are a mess. And with going to the library to get that book on counseling, which helped me tremendously, I was able to take that information and help my children as well. So I gave them what they needed, which is a mother and a father. And they needed to know the good, the bad, and the indifferent about their dad. And I told them that I'm your best resource, and I will only tell you the truth. Even if it makes me look bad, I'm going to tell you the truth, because that is what you are entitled to. I'm not going to puff it up. I'm not going to exaggerate. I'm not going to make it look like your dad was all wrong. I'm going to tell you the truth. And what you pull from that truth is what you pull from it. So I don't want you to feel like you can't come and talk to me, because I'm going to be biased. I'm not going to be objective. I will be as honest as I have to be with you, even if it makes me look bad. And that's how we were able to get through all of this. Because nobody was there to help my children through that. We tried to go to counselors, as I stated before, but there was one counselor in particular who told my son that he wanted him to contact Lee Malvo to find out how he felt about the issue so that he could help him to write a book. So when I found that out, I just pulled my children all in, and I took responsibility for all of their actions. And I recently told them, now that they're 18, 19, and 21, the reason I did all of that was because I could not have them in the news where the people would report, the journalists would report, the DC sniper's children did A, B, C, and D. I could not have that. I mean, I'm sorry you didn't go to the parties. I'm sorry you couldn't hang out with your friends, but the issue we were dealing with was much bigger and had more ramifications later on in life than just merely living from day to day. So I had to help them to understand the pressures that we all were under to stay as out of the press as we could, which we were very successful in doing that. And
what kind of schools did they go to?
I'm sorry?
What kind of schools did they go to?
They went to public schools.
They went to public school?
Yes, sir. And some of their friends knew, and other people didn't, because I kept their names out of the news. So the friends that did know, they protected them. They had their own entourage, so to speak. And if anybody came up against them or tried to hurt them, then their friends would step in and say, hey, you're not going to mess with them. They're my friends, and we're going to protect them. And those same friends that they had then are the friends that they have now.
You had to have given them a lot of strength for them to even have those kinds of friends. You gave them an incredible amount of strength.
All I know, Peter, was that I needed to protect my children.
Yeah.
And I had to do what was necessary for them to understand that, number one, we are not going to take responsibility for your dad's actions. We're not going to apologize to anyone for what he did. I was divorced from him for 2 years, running for my life, and I'm not responsible for him. And so this is what I had to try to instill in them. And I wanted them to go to school outside of the D.C. metro area because they needed to see what the other world looks like, feels like, and they also needed to hear what other people had to say about their dad. Now, it's totally up to them whether they want to tell the people that they are with who their father is. I left that completely up to them because that's their life now. I got them through high school. There are no drug issues, no substance abuse. Neither one of my daughters were pregnant. My son didn't get anybody pregnant, and I feel like that's a wonderful accomplishment because I told them that, you know, there are many adults that could not handle what you all went through. I mean, they were kidnapped and taken to Antigua. They were in the outskirts of Antigua, so they had to haul water, and in the water were worms, and they had to push the worms aside just to drink water. They had to take baths outside where people were walking back and forth where they could see them. When John left them to come to the United States, he didn't leave them enough food, so they had to go and find food. They went through a lot, too. And I remind them of that. Look, what you all went through wasn't no skip in the park. You all went through some stuff. So I'm not going to allow you to minimize what you went through. You went through a lot, and I'm proud of you because most adults would not be able to handle this, and then you come back and can sing operate in eight different languages, and you're a computer wizard. And I mean, come on, you guys.
I really appreciate how proud you are of them. It sounds like, bizarre as it is, that you're saying you got blamed for the deaths of other people in some way, and that's why you're telling us you've taught your children that the D.C. sniper was not your responsibility. I don't have a word for it. Who could have been so twisted as to accuse you of being to blame?
Many people in this community. I did an interview with the Washington Post with the community. And if you read those responses, you will see that they really tried to rip me up. And I was told that if I would have stayed with John, then he just would have killed me. If I would have stayed on the West Coast, then the people on the East Coast would still be alive. How dare I call me and my children victims when we were not killed? And I should apologize to everyone that he's harmed. And I've taken a stance, and I hope I don't come off as arrogant or as being insensitive to the individuals who were killed and their family members, but he is not my responsibility. I feel like we don't owe anybody an apology because we were victims too. And we may not have been physically harmed, but there was a lot of emotional abuse that I had to work through for myself and for my children just to get them to where they are now, where they can be productive adults in society. And that took a lot of work, and I had to do that on my own. And I just don't understand why we are being blamed and why others feel like we should apologize for what John did. He made a clear, comprehensive plan that included innocent people to kill me. And I tried to tell people how dangerous he was in killing me. I had no idea he would take it outside of us. But I knew Peter, I knew just as surely as I'm speaking to you on this phone that John was going to kill me, and it was going to be a headshot from a distance. I knew that.
To clarify for the listener, the notion is, and it's, of course, not just yours, it was the prosecution and the defense, the judge didn't want it brought in, was that by establishing a pattern for a DC sniper, then when he killed you, it would be blamed on the DC sniper.
Correct.
And then he wouldn't have been particularly singled out, even though he otherwise would have been an obvious suspect.
Correct.
And he tell us, tell us more about your survival and growth.
I'm sorry?
Tell us more about your survival and growth. Is there a spiritual aspect, a religious or spiritual aspect to the strength that you have and that you've given to your children?
Well, we are Muslims, and I just tell them that we have to be focused and understand that things, when things happen, we have to try to look at the big picture, and we have to try to find the silver lining in every single day, because we're not promised tomorrow. We're not even promised the next 5 minutes. So I try to teach them to live in the now. It's good to have plans, but you need to learn to live in now, because this is all you have right now. And whatever it is that come up, we're going to face it head on, we're going to deal with it, and we're going to move on, and we're not taking any baggage with us. Because when you take baggage with you, it weighs you down, and you can't see the blessings that are in front of you, because you're always looking back at what the pain was. Can't do anything about the past, but we can do a whole lot about the future. And that's what I've told them. And so I remember my son was telling me about one of his friends was going through some type of issue, and he said, "Mom, you know, you taught us to just deal with it and keep moving. I don't understand why other people can't do that." I say, "Well, you know, I can't answer that. People have to go through their own process and what they've been taught, and because you know how to do that, then you have to be patient with other people's process. You can't hurry them along. You can't make them do anything. You have to just be patient. So just be patient. He'll figure it out. Just wait." And that's what I've taught him. You have to respect the process.
It's good teaching. It's good teaching. tell me about, where did you grow up? A little bit about
Louisiana,
your background.
Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Where in Louisiana?
Baton Rouge.
Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. Okay, the second largest city, right, in Louisiana?
Correct.
It's a lovely place to grow up, I would imagine, in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm, it is. It was.
Mm-hmm. And how big a family did you come from?
I have 4 sisters and 1 brother. I'm the baby girl. My brother's the baby. So my mother had 2 sets of family, of children, because we're like 9, 10, 15 years apart.
And it sounds like you did a lot of self-education along the way in your life.
How much formal
education did you have?
I graduated from high school and went to some college, but I had to drop out to help my mother with the bills. So now I'm at Everest Online taking criminal justice classes to get my degree.
Well, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote this book and you taught yourself counseling. By the way, I didn't want to interrupt the marvelous flow of your conversation, but I was dying to ask, do you remember the name of the counseling book that was so helpful to you?
I don't know if it was Intro to Counseling. I just know that I saw a book that said Counseling for You and Your Children, and I went for that book, and I read it, and I applied the practices that it said for me to do. And the first thing it said for me to do was to be honest. Be honest and open, and make sure that your communication stays honest and open. And that's where I took it. We're going to be open, and we're going to be honest, and we're going to tell each other how we feel. We're going to be tactful. We're not going to just spew out venom to hurt the other person, and we're going to deal with this every single day. So we watched all of the news. We watched all of the documentaries. We watched everything. And then after we watched, I said, so tell me how you feel. Tell me what you got out of that. How did you feel about this? What do you think about your dad? How do you think your dad was feeling about this? That's how we dealt with it.
That's amazing. I just, the courage to do that is astonishing to me, and the wisdom to do it, and also the risk taking, because, I mean, you were treading where no woman had tread before. I mean, this is amazing that you took that on.
But
and
they
it turned out
know.
So well
they
for
needed
you
to
and
know
children.
The truth. It was all about my children. They needed to know the truth, even if it make me look bad. They needed to know the truth. They needed to know. My book is dedicated to my children.
Yes, I see that. The book again,
so that
scared.
They will know the truth. My book is based upon my journals. I didn't name my book Scared Silent because I was so scared I didn't do anything. I named it Scared Silent because I was so scared I had to work under the radar so that John couldn't find me before I found my children.
Tell us about the work you're doing on behalf of domestic people subjected to domestic abuse.
I founded my own organization called After the Trauma. It helps survivors of domestic violence because once I came out of it, there were no agencies to help us. Number one, they didn't label us victims, so we didn't get victims, advocates, we didn't get guardian items, we didn't get anything. And I had to go about the process of trying to piece our family back together, kind of like a puzzle. So each piece came from different places in order to put us back together whole. So, of course, when you put in a puzzle back together, it's not going to be the same pieces that it was when it was broken. There are going to be cracks in some places that weren't, and there are going to be holes in some places that it wasn't. But I got to be able to fill that in order to make us whole again. And then that's what I did. It was hard, but that's what I did. And so with domestic violence, that's what I try to teach other women. The first thing I say to them, you have to stop reacting and start acting. Because as long as you're reacting to what he or she is saying to you, then you're always off balance. But once you start acting, then you're on point and you are distracting or causing the abuser to be off balance. And that's what you want to do. Most victims and survivors don't understand that the abuser is using what they know against them to keep them off balance. But we as victims and survivors, we don't always use the information we know about the abuser to keep them off balance because we're too afraid. And that's why I say stop reacting and start acting. Because if you can think like him, like I did with John, then you can learn to stay two steps ahead of him. And that's what I had to do. I had to start thinking like John and then stay two steps ahead of him to stay alive. And I did that for 2 years. So what I'm asking you to do is not hard. You just got to train your mind in order to understand that it's all about survival. You have to live. You have children you have to protect. And sometimes you're going to do things that other people may not understand. And that's okay because they're not in your situation. So you have to trust yourself. You have to trust your own instinct. You have to know that what you're doing is right, even when everybody else is telling you it's wrong. If I would have listened to the people around me, Peter, I would be dead. I would be dead. I had to trust myself. I had to believe that I knew what I was doing, regardless of what anybody else have to say, and that's why I'm alive today.
Now, when you're talking about that, about thinking one step ahead, you're talking about the period of time when you're actively hiding from him rather than when you're living with him,
with him as well, because you don't have to react every time that person says something. Sometimes it's best just to be quiet. My mother used to say, you know, being quiet is sometimes good. You don't have to respond to everything somebody says. Yeah. And once you stop responding, then you take that person off balance because now you're not doing what they thought that you would do. They use words that they know will hurt, and in your pain you will respond. So don't respond. don't say anything. Because whatever you say back, they're going to take that and use it against you again. So why say anything? Once you understand that, that's how you get empowerment. That's how you start to get your life back. You also have to have a comprehensive safety plan, which I have in the back of my book. All you have to do is fill in the blank. There's also a list of resources of all of the coalitions in the United States. So wherever you are, you purchase my book, you got a resource for your, if you are, find yourself in an abusive relationship. The safety plan has 8 steps. The number 8 means transformation. So you are transforming yourself from being a victim to a survivor in just filling out the safety plan. Step 8 gives you a list of all the things that you should take with you. The ones that are checked are the ones that are the most important in order for you to start your life over without him or her. The rest of them you can get on your own at any given time. But you don't want to leave those important things at the house where you find you have to go back, because that's when most women are killed, is when they go back to get information that they didn't put aside before. 80% of victims and survivors of domestic violence do not have physical scars. So what do you do for the 80% of the people walking around in pain? What do you do for the professional people who go to work and dread going home because they don't know what they're going to do? Domestic violence is just not for the low-income people. It's from the very poor to the very rich. Does not matter. It doesn't have a race, a color, doesn't have a creed, a culture. It doesn't have a financial or educational status. It happens to everybody. Everybody has been or is a victim or a survivor of domestic violence. And you either went through emotional, verbal, mental, economic, stalking, or the physical assault. Unfortunately, it is only the physical assault that law enforcement will respond to. The other ones, they don't.
Mildred Muhammad, it is so interesting talking to you, or really listening to you. I think this is one of the most interesting interviews I've ever done, and I think that it will be very helpful and enlightening to other people. One of the things that occurs to me as an author is that this book, which you didn't get published till 2009, should have come out in 2003 or 4.
I wasn't ready.
I would think that this could have been a book that would have been grabbed up with a huge advance by publishers, but I'm suspecting not so. What's the story of the publication?
It was location. You know, everything is about timing. And because of the sensitivity of this issue, most publishers didn't want to touch it.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah, that is bizarre. And because of when the book came out, they didn't do the publicity that they did for other people, because it came out in October of 2009, and the Attorney General had just asked for a execution date for John. Nobody knew he was going to be executed in 2009, because that's pretty quick if you look at the timing of how many people were on death row. And so they rushed it through. Here's my book, and now people are saying she's just capitalizing off of this. This really didn't happen. I'm really getting sick of seeing her on TV. Why is she saying this is domestic violence? That never came out in the media. Why is this? And so that killed it right there. So now, wow. I'm a national spokesperson for domestic violence. When I go to these domestic violence events to speak, they're trying to figure out, why is she a part of this? That wasn't domestic violence until they hear my story.
Right.
And then the first thing they say is, why didn't the media tell us this? I say, because the judge did not allow it in the trial. And they only reported what was in the trial.
Yeah, and I have confirmation of that, too. Mildred Muhammad, we got to finish in about 30 seconds, literally. Is there an email address for people to get in touch with you?
Yes, sir. My email address is afterthetrauma, T-R-A-U-M-A, @yahoo.com. My personal website is www.mildredmuhammad, Muhammad is M-U-H-A-M-M-A-D.com. And my organization is www.afterthetrauma.org. And we accept donations of whatever denomination, because we're trying to help other victims to stay alive, and it is becoming more and more prevalent as time progresses that this is becoming a serious issue.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin thanking wholeheartedly Mildred Muhammad, author of Scared Silent, for being on the Conscience of Psychiatry show.
Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.